Welcome, everyone, to the Nomad on Fire podcast, the show all about the digital nomad lifestyle coupled with financial independence. We'll also be exploring tips and tricks on other lifestyle optimization strategies. I'm your host, Eric. Thanks for being here. Let's jump right in. All right, Yaro Stark, welcome to the Nomad on Fire podcast.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. Super excited to be chatting with you. Should be a lot of fun. I think we talked about quite a few different topics that we might want to get into today, but some business content, some traveling, maybe chat about podcasting habits, kind of lots of good stuff for the yeah. listeners today.
A lot of topics I love. So sounds good.
Awesome. Cool. Well, yeah, I guess with that, if you don't mind, can you kind of get us started with just what your background and what your story is?
Yeah, I have to be careful because this can be like a half hour talk for like cover 20 years of, you know, online business. So I try and shorten it down, but the older you get, the more there is, right? So short version, got started online in the late 90s. 1998, I was 18. The dot-com boom was happening. So totally awesome combination of, you know, luck there with just trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life and having this great new medium kind of exploding. So naturally, I gravitated to like having a website and not really thinking that that would be my business, but it was like a card game business. For those listeners who know Magic the Gathering, it's a collectible card game with your dragons and your elves. And I played it pretty religiously in my like 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 year old phase of life, like in high school and in a bit in university. And naturally, you know, the first website is a hobby about your passion at the time. But like yourself, Eric, I was ultimately looking for some kind of business that would grant me financial and travel freedom. That was literally my main goals, not to have a job, not to have a boss, not to have an alarm to wake up to, and have that kind of, not that I knew the phrase then, but digital nomad potential in it. My card game business never really was that. It, you know, made $500 a month, but it was really good proving ground for learning internet marketing 101. And then while I was in university, I actually started what I call my first business. And it was my first attempt at creating that kind of lifestyle business. It was an essay and thesis editing service where I connected often English as a second language students studying at universities with academic professors, postgrads who have really good grasp of academic writing. And they provided an editing and proofreading service, not a writing service. They weren't writing papers for students, but they were certainly providing advice on how to improve the presentation of your ideas. And I was the website owner, middleman between that transaction. Long story short on that business, it was my first full-time income. And it was a little bit of a struggle initially to figure out how to make it completely digital nomad-esque. And I say that because I had this experience where I traveled. I was living, my hometown was Brisbane, Australia. I traveled down to Sydney and attended an event down there, but I kept having to leave the event to go to an internet cafe, which is clearly dating the time frame of this. We didn't have iPhones or, you know, you couldn't do everything on your phone back then. There was BlackBerry though, but you couldn't run your online business on a BlackBerry. At least it was difficult. So I had to keep going in and out of the internet cafes. And I said, this is not good. And to clarify, it's because students tend to submit their papers last minute. So jobs could come in at any time with a deadline. If I wanted to make sure we didn't miss that job, I had to check my email constantly. So I realized I need to outsource email. And that was actually, it kind of connects to what I do today. That was the first time I ever outsourced email. And it took a bit of back and forth learning how to hand over something as private and personal as email. About a month later, it worked. I had a stay-at-home mom as my first email manager back then. She basically took over running the business for me. It was kind of like an operations person because it all happened in email. And then I was free. I only had to do maybe an hour to 2 hours a week on that business. And I made a small salary overall in profit, like maybe $40,000 a year would come to me. But I was free to travel and, you know, I had this kind of income stream and I was maybe 24 at that point. So not rich, but certainly the realization of that dream. And then to kind of finish the whole story, because I had that freedom, I actually got into blogging and podcasting for the first time in 2005. Didn't see this coming, but I then just spent the next 10 plus years and somewhat still going now, almost 15 years later, becoming an online educator, certainly a podcaster, a bit of an on and off podcaster, to be honest, but I created courses, wrote ebooks, did a whole bunch of like email funnels, really dive deep into that kind of information marketing business model. Sold about $2 million over the next sort of 12 years of my own teaching products. Sold off the essay editing company once I realized the blog was becoming my main business. The card game business I sold off long before that as well. And fast forward to about 4 years ago, I started my current project, Inbox Done. So I kind of reached, I won't say the end of my coaching career, but I was certainly desired to move on to a new business with a different business model. And that's when I launched inboxdone.com, my current business, where we actually provide email managers to business owners, you know, founders, CEOs, that type of person. And here I am today, still very much talking about it and running it today.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I think that's a great place to pick up in the story. I definitely wanted to ask you a lot of questions about Inbox Done. You kind of mentioned, you know, outsourcing your own emails, but I guess what was kind of the genesis? Like, what was the like idea, kind of thought process behind starting Inbox Done?
So, I mean, if you really bring it back to the ultimate beginning, as you know, like if you want to scale a business and travel with a business, you need a combination of delegating to specialists and technology automation. So through my blogging business, I got very good at the technology automation side of things. You know, I had email autoresponders sending out emails to sell my products and services. Digital delivery, you know, someone bought something, they get a login email sent to them, an email sequence that helps them use the product. So it's very hands-off, and I love that about technology. But I still needed certain people like copywriter, web designer, you know, tech people. And for me, because I experienced email delegation all the way back with that first sort of full-time business, throughout my career since then, I've had either one, two, or three people managing email. To me, it was normal. Like I would never go back to doing that job once I'd done it. It was like, once you fly first class, you don't go back to coach and handle your own email kind of situation, right? And it surprised me because a lot of entrepreneurs I met, especially the solo, maybe freelance coaches, consultants, or anyone running a small business where they're kind of like the main center point, they were often trapped to their inbox. And I actually, it all came to a head to me in 2017 when I was in Vancouver and I was at a meetup for entrepreneurs. We're sitting around a dinner table. We're talking about our problems. The woman to the left of me says, I wake up in the morning and I opened up my inbox and I spend an hour and then I go to work and I, you know, I'm in and out of the inbox all day. It's like my to-do list dominating what I do. I go home, you know, eat dinner, put the kids to sleep, and then I'm up till whatever midnight still doing emails, and it never stops. I can't get on top of it. And I turn to her and say, well, I actually only respond to my emails, you know, once a month, roughly. And she's like, how is that even possible? Everything would fall apart if I did that. And I said to her, well, there actually are people, I have email assistants in place who on a, you know, 5 days a week basis go in there, respond to customer queries, you know, highlight whatever I need to know about. They do tell me about it, like they'll send me a Slack message, but I don't have to necessarily go in and deal with it myself. They're doing everything, customer support, they're routing jobs to other members of my team. So they kind of remove me as the bottleneck and most importantly, the mental stress of worrying about, am I getting back to my customers? Am I missing out on opportunities? And just seeing an inbox full of emails, knowing that that's my job, was off my plate. So I told her that and then she was like very interested. And of course I said, okay, I'm ready to start something new. I've actually thought about this idea for a while. So that's how it all came about. And long story short, my co-founder is Claire, and she's actually one of my email managers, or was one of my email managers running my blog coaching business. So she was one of three. We had 24/7 email support at that time. I said to her, let's start this. We'll do an MVP or an MVS, as I call it, minimum viable service. It'll be a test. See if we can get some clients, see if it's a profit margin we can make, see if the system we built for managing my email can be applied to other people and other industries and other business models. And it did. We got a couple of test clients back in 2017, and one of them still with us actually 5 years later, 4 years later. And yeah, we kind of did the test with them. It answered all those questions. Yes, we can do it for other industries. Yes, there's a profit margin. And, you know, yes, we could build a business around it. So we then went all in. We hired, we started hiring people, training them up. We've got a team of about 25 now working on various clients and email management. And it's a fun thing to sell because obviously it's freedom. You know, it's helping entrepreneurs break free so they can write a book or travel the world or get fit again or just double down on the creative tasks in their business. And that's a nice thing to help people do.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's cool. I'm sure it frees up so much time for different people. And yeah, managing the inbox and just, I've been there before, just, you know, responding to emails and you feel like it's your to-do list and you had a plan and you were going to work on, you know, something a certain day, but then then you get an email and it just distracts you and then you spend all day chasing down an answer to that different thing. So definitely have some good like specific follow-up questions there. What about in terms of like maybe privacy or like security, right? Like if you have, you know, different financial information or any of that kind of stuff coming over email, what any tips or I guess recommendations for people if they're worried about like giving away that part of themselves to a third party?
Yeah, I went through that. I obviously, you know, first time I handed it over, there's these thoughts in my head. A, they're going to see how much money I'm making in my business. They're seeing the customers buy stuff. Potentially, if this goes well, I might be handing over things like my PayPal account accessed to process refunds or upgrades or new product purchases. Not to mention just that idea, can someone represent me and reply to emails the way I want them to be? Because I'm the only one who can be me. So there's always that doubt about that. And to be honest, like I didn't know, and it took the going through the handover process. That's actually what we officially kind of call it now in our business. We take people through this process where we're learning. Like, for example, Eric, if you were to become a client, we would introduce you to your two email assistants, your basically executive assistants, who are going to learn what they can about you, everything that you do in your role. Obviously, they're going to step into your sent folder and look at all the emails you receive and how you reply to them currently. Try to understand the context of what you're trying to do. Really try to clone you, basically. Build templates and rules and they'll fill in the gaps by asking you questions. So like, you know, is there a prior relationship with this person who's emailing you? Should we prioritize it? Or is it spam? You know, there's a big difference between a real contact and a random spam. So, you know, learn all those things. And then to add like the privacy aspect too, you know, we have some clients who are doctors, lawyers, venture capitalists. So there's medical information, financial information, private confidential information. So we've had to kind of build systems to accommodate different people. As a basic rule, we're always using a VPN, so a virtual private network, to log in and access a person's computer, a little extra security. We use LastPass or another password manager of choice for accessing anything really, software, email, that protects the sharing of passwords. We don't necessarily see them and you can control that as a client. We also, as a basic rule, always have a fairly robust contract in place and we have an NDA within our own company and we can work with a like an NDA you might have that's specific to your business. And then there's like the next level. If we're dealing with like medical information that we just should not see, we will silo certain emails. So for example, set up a separate account. Only Eric, the doctor in this case, can see it. And those emails go to that separate section. And lately we started using another thing called DocSend, which is pretty simple, but it allows us to protect the sharing of attachments and documents. So rather than like attach a file, send it away, and perhaps someone else is sharing it with the wrong people, it controls who has access to seeing a file. So it's another extra layer of protection. But I'll be honest, the most important thing is learning about how you work and you telling us what is critical information, what do we have to worry about, what should we treat as a priority in your life. And then the beautiful thing is you get used to it. You start to like enjoy working with your assistants and trust them. And you go, I'm going to give them more. And suddenly you're giving them your credit card and they're paying for everything for you and handling all your invoicing. And you're not doing anything anymore because you've become comfortable with this idea of delegating to an assistant.
For sure. Yeah, it seems like it must be more than email management. Is that a fair assumption, right? Like for them to like really serve the clients well, right? They're going to have to kind of learn the ins and outs of your business and just kind of how you operate as a person, right?
Spot on. Yeah. We obviously email is like a gateway, and there's all these things that enter the inbox that will trigger using a task management software or customer relationship management software, or involving another team member, like an accountant or a webmaster or copywriter, all these people that we could interact with. So we're really executive assistants who specialize in the communication aspect of your business. We're jumping into social media, direct messages, replying to your groups, maybe Facebook. A lot of clients are starting to use paid ads, and you get all these comments to your Instagram ads, and it's like, oh, I don't want to go and deal with that. We can reply to every comment made to your Instagram ads or your Facebook ads, and so on. So anytime there's written communication, we can take over. And then yes, we can integrate with other software and other team members to get it done. And what we find is you kind of get comfortable with basic level email, and then you just start realizing, I could pass this on. One of the big things is calendar scheduling. Since a lot of people, podcast hosts included, as you know, and I know, there's a lot of back and forth with scheduling, reconfirming. We had to change this time and the day a couple of times, and that can be handled and reconfirmed via your assistant. So you just show up at the appropriate time, the information's there, and away you go. So that's a big one for people too.
I'll definitely link up Inbox Done in the show notes so everyone can check it out. But maybe if it's a small business owner or someone just getting started, like any other maybe like general tips in terms of like outsourcing email, like maybe they're not ready for kind of like a full kind of stack or setup. But are any other things that you've used in the past or have worked well for just kind of starting that like outsourcing or automation process?
Yeah. And maybe, take a step back and not just say email, because that's actually a big one to hand over. It's often one of the hardest things to hand over. And that's why we're not, a $200 a month service. We're more like you're going to expect to spend $2,000 a month. You're going to get a fairly regular 5 days a week dedicated team. Because email is 5 days a week and it's constant, you might want to start with delegating. In fact, through maybe not even delegating, through automation, as I talked about earlier. One of the first things I did was, yes, I delegated technology. So I had a website designer developer was my first ever hire before I hired anyone else, because that was my weak point. I was wasting too much time trying to make my website changes and so on. So I recommend people start there. And the good thing about that is you can start small, $100. Change this here, put my opt-in box there, update certain design elements of your blog, your website, landing page, whatever. And then you can kind of go, okay, what are the components? Like, I don't know the specifics of your business, but probably like a lot of us, you have an email list and you sell something via email and probably, blog posts and so on. And that's all technology that can do a lot without you being always the one there. So I learned really quickly after starting a blog that there's this thing called an email autoresponder where, and it sounds silly now, but it was new back then, where you can set up, a drip release sequence of messages that will go out over a period of time, and it will deliver this value, this content you create, and you don't have to be there. So you can be asleep. I remember it's actually probably the single most enjoyable moment of my entire entrepreneurial career. It was when I was like, after all the essay editing company, the card game business, I was blogging, and I was way more excited about this idea of having an email list and, very simple business model. You send some emails, you sell something through email, and you make money. But I'd never really experienced it yet. I just started with my blog and I had my first email list as part of that. So people would come to my blog, they join my email list, and I had maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people sign up within the first 2 years. And I hadn't done much to make money from my site yet. And I thought, okay, I'm going to test affiliate marketing. And I wanted to, A, test this theory about can I sell something just using my own blog, my own email list, you know, nothing else. So I wrote a blog post recommending an ebook, a little package, actually, of a few ebooks from this other person named Perry Marshall. He was like this guru of pay-per-click ads on Google back then, still is quite well known for that. And he had this package and it was 50% commission. So I'd make $25 per sale. And at first I just did a full-on test of, will anyone buy anything? So I wrote a blog post recommending the package. And then I sent an email to that blog post just to tell people, hey, check out my new blog post. It was a review of this ebook package. Initially, I got zero sales in the first 24 hours. So absolutely devastated. I thought this whole blogging thing doesn't work. I've just wasted 2 years of my life. What am I doing? 24 hours later, though, my first sale comes out while I was sleeping. And I'm like, oh, that was cool. $25 commission. And, you know, I wasn't doing anything at the time to make that money. And then maybe I think I made 5 sales in the next week or two. But it was proof of concept, made $100, maybe 150 from one blog post and one email. And I was like, that's awesome. Fast forward, I think a few months later, Perry's running his conference and he's got this crazy deal where you can buy tickets to the conference for $2,000 and you get a free laptop when you buy your ticket. And as affiliates, you could promote this offer and make $700 commission for any ticket sale you made. And I'm like, wow, free laptop, a ticket to an event, and I get $700. This is easy to promote. So same story, wrote a blog post, sent it to my email list. I think it was like a Friday when I did this. Nothing came through again immediately, but I was on the golf, not the golf course, like it was more like, I don't know if you guys have pitch and putt. Played that? Yeah. Yep. So I'm playing pitch and putt with some buddies of mine on a Saturday afternoon. And this is when I had a BlackBerry and ding, it says you made a sale and $700 came through. And you know, that's way better than $25. And I'm like, I just made $700 while I was playing golf. That's the cliche living the dream kind of experience, yeah. Right? So to me, nothing has topped that moment in time because it was like this proof of concept of digital information marketing online. Maybe I got lost answering your question there, but really, you know, email automation and then the people I've hired to kind of help me grow the business, it's a starting point I think we can all begin with because we can test small and potentially bring in, you know, big results.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I appreciate you sharing some insights there on kind of automation and in delegation and yeah, definitely using technology. There is some really cool email, yeah, I guess email list services. I don't know what to call them, but yeah, you can set up like full automations like in the funnel and have different sequences and stuff. That is pretty cool. One more kind of business related question. You know, I've definitely been, you know, doing some affiliate marketing and some different stuff as well. I think, you know, there's a lot of people probably listening that are really interested in that also. But I think the hardest thing that I found is kind of the growth piece of it, right? Getting your name out there and kind of growing the traffic to your blog or listens to the podcast. Any kind of general tips or anything that has really helped you in that regard in terms of really building that community and having just kind of more eyeballs on your stuff?
You know, it's the constant issue. Like from the moment I started, every website I've talked about, whether it was the card game business, then the essay editing business, then the blogging business, all the way to today with inboxdone.com, my job has been, how do I get more visits to this website? Usually to join an email list as part of that, maybe not. Sometimes it's just to sign up, you know, for a call and or make a purchase of an affiliate product, whatever it is, getting the attention. And for me, it's always been like a two-sided strategy. Like I know there's something I can do every day that's fairly easy for me to do, which is create content. That's always been comfortable for me. I can sit in a podcast and talk as an interview guest or interviewing someone else. I can talk solo. I can sit down at a cafe. I can write an article. I can write an email. So that part you control. And I think anyone who's a creator nowadays, whether it's, you know, YouTube video, TikTok videos, Instagram content, blogging, podcasting, that part you can control, but that doesn't mean you grow an audience. And that's the part you always have to accept. It's, you have to accept the old, if you build it, they will come analogy doesn't really work. There has to be some kind of exposure through external forces to get exposure to that content you're creating. Now, in my case, I've been very Google organic search dependent for most of my companies. So I've needed to produce written content, maybe video content, audio content. But I've always been aware of the need to build incoming links from other websites, both for the search benefit, but also for the exposure benefit directly. So, I mean, the simple example we can point to right now of doing that is what we're doing right now. So I'm talking to you on a podcast. I'm getting exposure to your audience, and you'll probably link to my website when you publish this podcast. You do that once, nothing really happens. You start doing that every week, multiple times, compounding kicks in, and eventually 12 months later, suddenly your rankings are better. You know, you've produced whatever it is, 30, 40, 50 articles. They're all starting to show up in search results. Your traffic's increasing. And some things are bigger hits, like a bigger podcast or exposure on a, you know, one TikTok video goes viral, or one connection you make with a person, they share a piece of content and you've suddenly got an extra few hundred to a few thousand people. And maybe some of them subscribe to your email list. So for me, it's always been content creation combined with some kind of exposure online. And most of the time it's been podcasts, but I've done paid advertising. I've done PR. I've done just, I guess, networking as well. You know, we off air, we were talking about being in Austin, going to a conference that can lead to a partnership where someone might just do a straight good old joint venture where they promote your webinar and you show up on the webinar and you pitch to their audience. I've done that as well. So I think, and that's the hard part, like that's the part whenever I've been coaching people on marketing, most people aren't comfortable with the idea that you have to go out there consistently and constantly and keep showing up over a long period of time. It's not easy. Marketing is a hard slog. It's not an overnight success story. Every person who's had any kind of success with marketing online has been consistently producing and consistently showing up in front of new audiences. It does seem sometimes like, you know, YouTube might favor certain people and suddenly all their videos are just showing up organically and they're getting all this free traffic. But that's because they produced 100 videos over the last 2 or 3 years. And now they're like being rewarded for all that hard work, that relationship building, that interaction with other people. It's the same story with podcasting, like you and I are doing now. You have a podcast. I have a podcast. It's hard. Like, I know producing a podcast, it's not the most organic form of content. Like, people don't easily just stumble across podcasts. You know, you have to actually ask your guests to promote it and share it on social, because then helps create exposure. You know, you have to maybe get, you know, I go on your show, you come on my show. So we're both sharing our audiences. Sometimes you have to do paid advertising. You know, there's all these different things just to reach people to hope they become subscribers. And while you're doing all that, you got to keep producing content. So, you know, it's not for the faint of heart, I think is the general rule. Hopefully you love producing content. Otherwise you shouldn't be in this game.
For sure. No, those are great, great insights. I appreciate you sharing those. Yeah, definitely. I think I've read a lot of articles about it, and I've had some good like exposure and success kind of trying to guest and be on other people's podcasts. I probably need to try to get on another circuit and reach out to some more folks. But yeah, that's a great way to kind of get organic exposure. Cool. Wanted to shift gears a little bit. Wanted to chat with you about traveling. So when, I guess maybe what year was it then that you had kind of automated the blog and in kind of coaching business? And then were you kind of living as a digital nomad at that point? Were you working and just kind of traveling all around? What does that look like?
Yeah, the best first taste I had of a proper digital nomadism was 2008. So to put that into context, 2007, I sold Better Edit, the essay editing company. I also launched my first course, Blog Mastermind, and that ramped my income up to about $15,000 a month. So first time I'd broken a six-figure a year kind of income. It was a very digital business, good profit margins, very easy to travel with. It was lean. It was me, my email manager for content, for customer service, and my web designer tech person for website updates. The rest was me. I was writing articles, writing emails, doing podcast interviews. So I thought, now's the chance to really do a proper trip overseas, and open-ended. So I basically said, I'm going to make my way to Canada from Australia. I have most of my family were in Canada. I was born and raised in Australia. But, and this is kind of silly, but not a fan of long flights. back then, especially, really had bad anxiety, especially with turbulence. That was not pleasant for me. And Australia's far. So you always have to do like a 9-hour flight just to get anywhere besides New Zealand. You know, you go to Hawaii, you go to Japan, any of those places that are close are far. So I decided to island hop, and I went to Fiji and then Hawaii and then Vancouver. I won't go into every city, but I ended up doing a 9-month nonstop kind of trip, 26 different cities, complete circle around the planet. After being in Canada, I dropped in and out of the States for a few events and then traveled over to Europe. First time actually being in Europe. So did all the normal big cities, you know, London, Paris, went to Amsterdam. I was in Belgium briefly. And then went to back to England, and then I went to Athens. I remember this all as well because I was actually launching my second course while I was in a city called Voulogmeni, which is about an hour outside of Athens. And I had a partner in that. We were creating a video course. So it was my first ever video course as well. And he was all the way back in the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, Australia. And I was sitting in this kind of beach town in Athens or in Greece. And we're coordinating this launch. And I remember such a cool feeling because we were talking from literally the opposite sides of the planet using Skype. And we're planning the launch of a product. You know, he's making videos. I'm preparing emails to go to my email list to get our first customers. And it's 100% virtual. I could have done that anywhere. I had, you know, access to email. And we ended up having a huge launch, that product, not from the one launch, but over the lifetime of maybe 2 years, 2.5 years of selling it, sold over $1 million worth of memberships into the program. Wow. And it all started from that kind of collaboration while I was in Greece. And, It never got old. Like doing that there, I remember being in Rome, sitting in a cafe, writing an email promoting someone else's affiliate course, like a promoting a course, and not a lot of money. You might make $4,000 or $5,000 if you sell 4 or 5 people into someone else's program. But it was like from sitting in a cafe in Rome where you send 2 or 3 emails recommending someone else's program. And I was like, when in history have we had this kind of potential to travel, to earn? And for me, I love content creating and doing it in new environments and new languages, new cultures, new scenery, new architecture. Very exciting. And I really think back to that trip, and maybe in the last 3 or 4 years too, when I've been to a few new places like Ukraine and Poland and Croatia, and even Austin for the first time just a couple of weeks ago, you know, just being able to run a business and live that nomad lifestyle. It is truly a unique time in our history. Never been able to do this until like the last sort of 20 years.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely pretty incredible time in history. And, you know, maybe a little bit of a step back with COVID, but I think with more people being able to work remotely, I'm excited, really excited to see what the future looks like in terms of work and travel programs, kind of co-work, co-living type of spots, like just the infrastructure around the nomadic lifestyle and to support remote workers kind of all over the world. I'm excited to see what that looks like. How about you in terms of, I guess, like travel style or different accommodations? Like some of the more recent trips, were you usually staying in Airbnbs, or what do you kind of prefer in terms of like the, you know, accommodations?
So that 2008 trip was interesting because there was no Airbnb yet, but there was, and I feel funny saying this, Vrbo, which some more, I guess, seasoned travel hackers will know about. It, for me, it was not Vrbo. That's just the way they say it today. It used to be called VRBO, which is Vacation Rentals by Owner.
Yeah. Did they like come out with the branding? Like, I remember seeing commercials about them. Like, I feel like everyone already calls it VRBO.
Yeah, I think what happened is they realized, you know, no one wants to say VRBO, and they could make it for the new generation who didn't know them. And they're kind of like, you know, the comparison is obviously Airbnb. They want something that's easy to remember. So they say Vrbo. And I was like, I remember I was actually, when I was in Austin, I'm at the hotel. I was in a hotel that time. And no, I wasn't. I was actually staying in a friend's place. But anyway, I'm watching TV and I see the ad for this VRBO, but they say Vrbo. You know, I was like, Vrbo? What's Vrbo? I was like, okay, fair enough. Rebranding or pronunciation. But so anyway, you know, I was traveling in that trip using VRBO for the first time. And man, I felt like a genius because no one else I'd heard of ever at that time was staying in other people's apartments and homes as they traveled the world. Back then, it was either couch surfing or hostels or hotels. You know, if you're really broke, you couch surf. If you're semi-broke, you hostel. If you're doing okay, you hotel, right? That was pretty much the criteria. So I was mostly, you know, hoteling. Obviously, I did a pretty good launch and I was enjoying that to that point. But then I discovered a VRBO. And I'm like, so in Voulogmeni in Athens, I'm staying in someone's apartment. I think I mixed it up. It was a combination of hotels, family while I was in Canada, and VRBOs. New York, I had an apartment. Florida, hotel. Paris, God, I remember some crazy apartments in Europe, you know, when you've got to walk up 20 flights of steps because they don't have you know, elevators in some of the old European apartments, which is an experience in itself, but, you know, carrying a massive suitcase up 20 flights of stairs was horrible, but it was still cool. You know, you're in someone's apartment in Paris, in Florence, you know, in Dubai, I think I stayed in a hotel. Anyway, you know, full range of experiences, but I remember recording videos in a lot of those VRBOs. Cause I was like, this is what you can do. You can travel and stay in someone else's house. This is the kitchen, you know, this is the bedroom. And that was just exciting. You know, nowadays we don't do that because, well, some people do still, but you know, it's so common. And I guess, you know, to give my answer to your question though, now today, I still prefer mostly an Airbnb. I do like to cook as an option, not always, like a short trip. I probably won't. Like I didn't cook in Austin. I was in Miami after Austin. I didn't cook there either. And I stayed in a hotel in Miami because sometimes it's actually cheaper. Like in Miami, it was cheaper to stay in a hotel than it was in Airbnb. So I said, all right, well, this is close to where I want to be. I'll stay in a hotel. So I tend to mix it up. But one thing I haven't done yet and I'm eager to try next are co-sharing, co-living kind of spaces where,
yeah,
like Outsite and Anyplace, there are a couple I've been following and I'm on their newsletters. And I'm like, I like the idea of, it's kind of like an Airbnb. You get your own bedroom, possibly your own bathroom, but there might be a shared kitchen. It's not a hostel in the sense that it's cheap living. Maybe six people are staying there. Some of them are even set up for podcasting. Like I know, I think Outsite or maybe Anyplace is setting up like digital creator setups. And when you know, you rock up and it's like what I've got now, I'm talking to you with, you know, the big screen, the microphone, the lighting, that's all there. You just bring your laptop, you connect it and away you go. So plus you get to meet other digital nomads who are living in that space, which I think is something that's sometimes missing, especially if you're solo traveling, which I know you've done somewhat, Eric. So let me get to try that as well.
I almost stayed at, it might have been an Outsite. I forget which one it was. I almost stayed in one in Bali and I'm kind of mad that I didn't, just so I would have had the experience so I could have, like, you know, speak more to it. But
about it. Yeah. Bali seems to be a hotspot for that too. Like a lot of those kind of co-working, co-living spaces there.
Yeah, there was quite a few when I was like doing some research, but then I ended up just kind of staying in like a guest house because it was just super cheap. So that's what I went with. But I am definitely like kind of future travels. I'm excited to try out like a co-work, co-living type space. And yeah, I think you're right in the sense that it's maybe, it is kind of, depending on the place, probably shared living setup, you know, kind of like a hostel, but it's geared more towards remote workers. So you're probably going to run into to other, you know, online business owners, entrepreneurs. That was kind of going to be my next question. Like in terms of, you know, going to a new place, what's, well, kind of few part question. What, In terms of like meeting new people, like what's your kind of strategy there? Where have you found success in terms of kind of making connections, meeting new friends? And then also, Do you have like a set routine when you arrive in a new place to like get set up quickly to be productive?
You know, it's changed. I've traveled with my current girlfriend. I've traveled with past girlfriends. That's completely different to when you're a single guy or single girl, I guess, too. And also, what's your purpose? I've traveled specifically for an event. Sometimes I've traveled because I know someone and I want to go to a new place. One time I traveled from Lviv in Ukraine to London via train, stopping in all these places while I was writing a book. And it was kind of like, I want to experience that almost romantic idea of writing a book while I'm, crisscrossing Europe and trains and, sitting in cafes. And that was 100% solo. And my intention was just find cafe, write. So I know for me, though, I do have a kind of a routine where I land in a new place and I always want to orientate myself first. So make sure I'm comfortable with how to get into my home. I get a little paranoid especially when I'm solo, like worrying about, and if I'm solo and I don't know anyone in a city, you got no emergency contact. There's always that sense of like I'm a lone sailor in an ocean with no one kind of situation. So I always think, okay, let's make sure my living arrangement, I feel very comfortable about it. I know how to get in and out. Don't have to forget about the key or the code to get into the place. Internet access is good. Batteries are charged on the phone and the laptop, those basic kind of things. Once that's in place, I feel comfortable about my travels. Then I'll kind of go, all right, let's explore either the local area, or one of my simple things I love to do is open up the map. And I'm sure you know about this. When you open up Google Maps, there's like yellow parts in cities, and the yellow usually refers to more restaurant, cafe, sort of hangout spots where you're going to find those kind of, it's not just, suburban streets or Walmarts or things like that. It's a little bit more classy or, I guess, not touristy, but villagey. You're going to get a village kind of experience. So more often than not, I'm staying at a place that is near a street of that kind. So I go and just check that out. And, you're figuring out, where's my grocery store? I feel silly saying this, but the most enjoyable thing I love, and I experienced this in Austin, is finding a local organic grocery store. It's a little bit pricey, but I do love, I'm dairy-free, so you always discover a new dairy-free ice cream that you didn't have in your home city or another city, and it's like, ooh, going to try that. I'm also a chocoholic, so sometimes like there's a new chocolate bar, I'll try that. And just the simple things like knowing that, okay, I can buy supplies here for whatever I might want. And it depends, because sometimes I'm cooking for myself, so I will use that as my grocery store. For example, in Austin, I knew I was going to literally eat every meal out. So I went in there and, bought the ice cream and stuff like that, but I didn't buy, cooking supplies. So I kind of go through that whole process. Pass a day or two or three days go by and you totally feel comfortable. You know where your food is, you know where your shelter is, you got your feel for everything. And then what I tend to do, especially if I'm solo, is I walk and as far like everywhere. What I'll do is I'll maybe look for another yellow zone that I haven't been to before. I wouldn't have done this until recently, but I'll use the share scooters. Austin obviously has a lot of those around. So in Austin, I did. It wasn't always available, but a scooter to get to a place is helpful. Prior to that, I might have used the phone to help me figure out even just the public transport system. Can I just get on a bus and go to another area? And sometimes I'll just walk. I will literally go for a 4-hour walk or a 5-hour walk throughout the day. I'll stop at a cafe. I'll get to a new place. And I love that because you really get a feel for different areas and the connections between them. And that's really like, I was like with Austin, I was in the city, but I was in, I can't remember the side, the south side, like over the bridge, over the Bat Bridge. And there's that street. That's where I was staying. And then I went up to the University of Texas and checked out that kind of area. I love Whole Foods. So I'll often find, if there is a Whole Foods, if I'm in America, I'll go wherever that is and check out that area. that's obviously not something you do in Europe, but I just find that a great way to explore a city. And then I guess the last thing which you did mention is the meeting of people part. Like, I can do a lot by myself. I'm an introvert, so I can be pretty comfortable doing that. I especially love it though when there is one person who will help you at least integrate a little bit with something that's happening local. I find this really helpful. So if you have like that one person, you know, like I don't know you, but I feel like now if I went to Austin, I might say, hey, you know, Eric, are you around? Any events you're going to coming up? Even something simple, like are you hosting some kind of get together somewhere? Or is there someone I could meet who you know? And that kind of into the local scene, I find is helpful. But I'll be honest with you, it tends to only work, I find, when you're in a city for long enough. Like my week-long trips, I find I struggle to really, you know, unless it's a conference or a meetup, or I know the person I'm going to meet and there's going to be something we're going to do, I tend to not integrate well. But, you know, like I stayed in Vancouver for a few months and one person connected me with another. That person happened to run local meetups. He invited me to speak. I spoke at the event, which then led to meeting two other people. And suddenly I've got four friends in Vancouver and I can go back there and I can reintegrate with them whenever I like. You know, I went to Ukraine. There I didn't speak the language. So it's super challenging without having the Ukrainian. English it's available, but not super yeah, I mean, the younger people certainly have more English, but it's not easy. Let's put it that way. And it's almost like I love it when I do get to speak to someone in English. It's like, oh, English, that's great. You know? And I met a business partner there, and that's helped me to kind of connect with a few other people, but it hasn't been easy. Like when I was in Ukraine, I really struggled. In fact, I met more other expats who were either traveling through or staying there. And I did join a co-working space specifically with the hope of meeting more people because I was going to be there for like 3, 4, 5 months, but I was actually there to set up a solar farm at that time, which is another story in itself, but that was a commitment to be in that city for a good amount of months. So I knew I'd, you know, really have to meet more people. And I should be absolutely honest to kind of answer the question completely. When I was traveling single, let's not forget dating apps. You know, they do help you to meet locals, even if it isn't within a dating context. And that has helped too. I've, met people, you may be going a few dates and maybe it doesn't work out, but you've actually met someone who then might integrate you in their social circle a little bit, even if the dating part doesn't continue, or maybe it does, but you know, there's always that as well.
For sure. Yeah. Those are great tips. I appreciate you sharing those. And when you're talking about kind of like just walking around exploring a city, that's one of my like favorite things. I think it's kind of, for me, it's kind of the whole process. Like I love before I go to a new city, like I'll have Airbnb pulled up and then I'll have just like Google Maps pulled up in another tab. And I'll look at different places that I want to stay, do some research. I'll see if there's like a grocery store, a gym, and like a co-working space in like a close walking proximity. And then once I like finally decide, I love actually being in that place. And then you research and you saw everything on Google Maps like 100 times. And you, like the first time you get to walk around and actually see it in person. It's a great feeling.
How many places have you been to, Eric? Like what's your count now for cities?
I would say my count of countries I visited, it isn't that high in the scheme of things. But cities, like I did remote year for 4 months throughout Latin America. So I was in Santiago, Chile, Lima, Peru, Medellin, Colombia, and then Mexico City.
Is that like the official remote year? I know there's like a company that runs that. Was that what you were doing? Or
yeah, I did like the program. Yeah, I went through.
Oh, nice. How was that? Is it, you recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it. Yeah, I have a full like review on my site. I can link it up in the show notes. Can check it out. But yeah, I thought it was great. Like I was, you know, new to the digital nomad lifestyle at the time. So it was worth it to me to pay a little bit more. Like you could definitely, you know, live as a digital nomad much cheaper on your own. But I thought the community aspect of it was fantastic. Like they have a Slack community, so there's, you know, like 3,000 something people in there. So anyone who's ever done remote year, you could connect, kind of network with them. So it's a great, and if people are still traveling, it's a great way to maybe find like a person in a new city that you might know, or at least have some sort of in or connection with them. Like, hey, saw you did remote year two. And then being on the actual program, same thing. It was like great from the community aspect. There was like 28 people in my group. So it was oh, fun. Wow. Kind of like an adult
awesome.
Study abroad. So you had those just like friendships and social aspect.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Yara, we're getting towards the end on time here. I just have one last question for you, and then we can wrap it up. I wanted to ask you about daily habits. Like, what are some, either on like a daily or weekly basis, what are some things that you do to keep you happy, healthy, productive? Could be all of the above. Could be personal or business related.
I mean, exercise for me is something that has to happen, or I very quickly start to feel, agitated, sore, can't sleep as well, all those things. So, and it can be simple. Obviously, when you're doing these 4-hour walks around a city, you're pretty tired by the end of it. But that's not enough. Like, obviously, you're working your legs and maybe a bit of cardio, but your whole body's not getting worked out. So, I actually like having a gym. When I stay at hotels, I do look specifically for a hotel with a gym that I can make use of. When I was in Ukraine for that 4-month stay, I signed up for a local gym, which was, even that was fun, trying to figure out how to sign up in Ukrainian and hanging out with all these naked men in Ukrainian, getting changed. That was like, well, very confronting. I had an experience, because it's very European to be just totally comfortable with your nakedness and walking around. So, and Germany too, actually, I had a similar experience there. And they had like the men's and women's showers were almost linked. I was like, okay, this is intense. But exercise for sure. I've maybe like, it's funny you're asking me this now. I'm probably the least, that's not true. I've always kind of not reacted well to dairy. And I've learned a long time ago, the documentary Food Matters. I don't know if you've heard of that one, but it came out. I remember actually, because I was in Toronto when it came out, and I saw one of their first ever showings of it. And there was that food movement then, like the raw food movement. I think the keto movement was sort of starting around then. Obviously, the low carb movement, and there's Tim Ferriss with the slow carb movement. All these different kind of alternative ways for maintaining your health. And I kind of realized through experimentation, my body definitely reacts to certain foods. So I've had to be clear about, definitely not dairy. For a while there, I was not eating eggs because I reacted pretty bad to egg whites. And then just certain foods, but try to keep away from excessive amounts of carbs. Sometimes you go through a binge, you land in a new city. It's like, oh my God, there's all these new cookies and Whole Foods. I gotta eat a whole packet. And then you regret it the next day. So it's kind of like trying to keep that balance. One thing I have noticed, the older I get, the less I seem to need to eat compared to, your teenage self, where you just eat as much as you want and nothing changes. So the glory years, unfortunately, are over. So that, I do feel like food is a big part of maintaining the habit, the structure, and even just the act of, eating and going out for food while you travel is part of a ritual as well, So, but really the most important habits, was those, obviously health is number one. You don't have your health, you can't do anything else. But for productivity, growing a business, I've really benefited from early studies I did into some concepts, some of which most people have heard of, like the 80-20 rule. That's been popular for a long time. I learned about that early 2000s. So even before, Tim Ferriss had his 4-hour work week, I was reading from Richard Koch, who wrote pretty much all the books on the 80-20 rule. And I was like, okay, I understand. It was a real aha moment for me. I was like, all right, I can just do these few tasks each day that were the biggest moving my business forward tasks. And I also understood the power of compounding. So I was like, okay, if I do the most important tasks, that 20% that move the needle, and I do them over time so they compound, the results will come in. Now, I had a lot of self-doubt around that in my early 20s because I hadn't experienced it yet. Compounding takes a while. But fast forward, I'm sort of in my late 20s. I've been doing this for 10 years. I start to see the fruits of that. And I'm like, okay, it's not a foregone conclusion, but I can see the outcome now. And that gave me confidence to carry that kind of habit forward. So even today, like I'm very comfortable making an experiment, and you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I don't get caught up by something that you'd call a failure. It's just a test, an experiment. I let it go. When something does work, I just do it on a consistent basis. So I've been writing of some kind of writing, whether it was for my blog or even today, it's for inboxdone.com. I'm chief marketing officer. So I'm not the only one writing. I have a copywriting team, but I do a lot of the editing and the final polish. And I am in charge of the content structure. And I know that's one of those 80-20 tasks. Keep producing content focused on the right keywords, keep growing links. 6 months later, maybe nothing has happened. 12 months later, you start to see your rankings improve. 2 years later, it's a long time, but suddenly you've got all these free customers coming in because of all this work you did over the last 24 months. So it's nice to have that confidence that these things work and that sense of knowing the systems and the processes. And to kind of tie that into, I should say, when I discovered the 80-20 rule, I was having a bit of a crisis of focus because it was around, you know, after graduation from university, my friends had moved into typical corporate jobs. They had a secure $40,000 to $50,000 a year income. They were, you know, following a career path. I didn't. I never wanted a job. So I was kind of at this casual job at the library at the university. I was trying to grow my essay editing company. And I felt like I was lazy because I'd wake up at 10 a.m., I'd turn on the computer, I'd do a couple of hours, then I'd, you know, cook lunch for half an hour, I'd watch an episode of Star Trek at, you know, at home for an hour, maybe I'd go for a walk or a swim or something in the afternoon, and then I'd do a couple more hours late at night. And I'm like, I don't think I'm hustling enough, because people talk about you got to do 8 hour, 10 hour, 12 hour days as an entrepreneur, and I'm doing 2 hours here and 2 hours there. So I was concerned that I was going to fail because I was too lazy. Then I discovered the 80-20 rule, and then I realized, okay, if I use those two blocks of 2 hours to do the most important tasks, things will move forward. So identify those tasks, do them over and over again, compound. I had to combine that with having the right business models. You know, there's a lot of things that you need to get right in a business, learning how to market something, positioning, copywriting, systems, delegating, all the things we've talked about. But as long as I keep adding and compounding, it starts to come together. And of course, the older you get, the more you can leverage your previous experiences to have confidence about the future. So today is still the same. I will do a couple hours in the morning. I went for like a 2 hour bike ride this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And then like I had dinner, and now I'm talking to you at 7 p.m. on an evening. And I call it, this is work for me, obviously, but it's a hell of a lot of fun. But it is a form of marketing too. So, you know, it falls into that compounding 80-20 bucket. And that's a habit I know, like for anything I do, that's the answer. Find the most important tasks, do them every day, balance your energy, stay healthy, and just keep moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing those. I felt like that was a good, like a really good kind of summary of your philosophy. So I appreciate you kind of sharing about the 80-20 rule. And I'm definitely agree with you. I'm definitely in the camp of work smarter, not harder, right? It's not about the hours you're putting in every day, but it's where you're focusing your efforts on. And if you're really working on those things that move the needle. Yeah. I also really like that you mentioned the food piece. Well, usually when I ask people about the habits, I feel like the food piece doesn't get brought up as much. But for health, like the big three to me are sleep, food, and exercise. I feel like the food can oftentimes get overlooked. But I'm with you. There's definitely some things that I know if I eat it, I'm just going to feel sluggish and kind of tired the rest of the day. I've done Whole30 a few different times, is good. It's pretty restrictive, but it's a nice system. Like once you're kind of a week or so in, you start feeling amazing. And then it's cool because you like reintroduce different food groups. If anyone hasn't heard of Whole30, like you reintroduce different food groups kind of one at a time. So you really kind of see how your body reacts to dairy or gluten or whatever it might be. So
yeah. It's such a good point. Like, I have a friend named Laura. She was my and still is actually our hiring manager with my current company, but was for my blogging business too. And she has recently, not recently, in the last few years, she's been on the AIP diet. So like an autoimmune protocol, very restrictive as well. Like you have to go right back to basics. It's meat and vegetables. That's it. Not even like things like salt. Wow. You know, you have to really take out everything. And the idea is to calm any hormonal immune system responses. And I know I don't want to dive into her personal life, but the connection to what her physical ailments were, I would have not thought, oh, it's diet. You know, you would have thought it's, oh, I got to go to the doctor. I got to get surgery. I got to take drug treatments. But then she went on AIP and she discovers that this health condition, it turns out, as like you were saying, reintroducing foods, it was nightshades causing a lot of reactions to her. And I would never think it's, oh, it's potatoes and sweet potatoes and all these things that grow in the ground that's causing the reaction. So, I mean, it sucks because you can't have the potatoes and all those things anymore. Mm. But it's so much better than having surgery and removing a part of her body now that she knows, you know, it's this this type of food that was causing that reaction. So I think it's the most important thing. And unfortunately, it's hard because there's so many good foods in our grocery stores and in our restaurants that we always feel like we're massively restricting ourselves when we do go on these diets, like we're missing out on life. And that's a challenge.
Yeah, it can definitely be difficult for sure. Cool. Yaro, this has been a lot of fun. I'm really glad that you were able to chat with me today. And I thought there was, great conversation and lots of value for the listeners. If people want to connect with you, they want to hear more about you and your story, where's the best place to find you at online?
Yeah, so if like the start of our conversation, if they want to get an email assistant or two or three, inboxdone.com to hand over basically executive assistant tasks, check that out. And for, I guess, it's my whole, my blog and my content and my podcast. It's all at yaro.blog. So yaro.blog. And you can find everything about me there.
Perfect. I will link them up in the show notes. Awesome. Yaro, yeah, this has been so much fun. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Thanks. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Nomad on Fire podcast. If you like the show, if you could do us a huge favor, and please subscribe on whatever platform that you're using to listen to this. If you could also leave a 5-star review, that would really help us out and allow the show to be available to more people. See you next time on the Nomad on Fire podcast.